You are listening to the Cerberus Podcast with a K, available on Cerberus.com, iTunes, Stitch.com, and Audio Boo.
It's podcast time, ladies and gentlemen. James McLean's over there. How are you, James?
Sitting here, topper on your left, or maybe it is your right. It could be either, depending on what side of the world you're looking at it.
Could be directly in front as well.
It could be, couldn't it? Or it could be just breathing over your shoulder, tickling your neck with my warm coffee-stained breath.
Creepy. Mm. And I'm Christian Corley, editor of Cerberus, and I'm currently enjoying a piece of Christmas cake and fine, mature cheddar. A little bit late, you'll probably think. But then again, it's too early for port, so I've got a cup of tea with it. The Christmas cake just hasn't gone down. It's like that Paddington Bear episode when he makes dumplings.
The one that we all know. People across the world will catch that, won't they? And they'll know.
They should do, don't they? It's like the Bagpuss one with the chocolate biscuit factory, isn't it?
Absolutely. With 13 episodes of Bagpuss ever made, I'm sure everyone around the world gets that. in 1977 or whenever it was.
Probably
Jesus
earlier.
Christ.
Oh, we'll have some show note help there, I think. Now, Brian, you may have noticed, is not with us this week. He's had to go out on some emergency superhero training. However, we're planning on bringing him to you in a different way later in the week, talking to Simon Fisher-Becker, better known to you Doctor Who fans, as Dorin Moldavar, the man with no body, after the Silent Monks lobbed his head off. The blue-skinned chap. Him. Interesting actor, interesting interview, so it's definitely worth you listening to. We're giving you that as a little extra. It's not really a thank you, because we were preparing to do this anyway. However, I'm a little bit embarrassed and humbled by this. Embarrassed in a very British kind of a way, not because I've, you know, stained my pants or anything like that. But basically, last week's podcast has proved...
You sure you've not had the port?
Yes. Last week's podcast has proved remarkably popular. So thank you, dear listener, over 8,000 times. And that is eight, James. It's gone up since we last spoke on Saturday. It's 8,000. Right. Over 8,000 listens of last week's podcast, which is brilliant. Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much.
If you're still listening
to this week's, yes, absolutely.
That's always a testament, isn't it, of a good podcast. It's not the amount of listens, it's about how many the next one gets.
Exactly, yes.
Being prepared to be humbled next week when find we've got listener again, yeah. A single listener once more.
Yes. Well, we've always got a single listener.
We always have, haven't we, by definition.
Thousands of times. Mm. Now, we're recording this on Monday. It's the 20th of January. It is Tom Baker's 80th birthday today. Tom Baker... is, of course, the fourth Doctor Who, the man who made Doctor Who. It's difficult to say. He was the star of Doctor Who for 7 years. He was Doctor Who in the end credits until his final year. Let's be honest. And I think it's fair to say that he defined the role for the vast majority of certainly older fans and many younger fans. I think in some ways, once they've gone back from the current series and viewed some of the older things.
Well, I think he defined the role as much within itself, because if you take sort of Pertwee, you take Troughton, you take Hartnell, Troughton a little maybe, but by and large, the facets of the Doctor you'll see today, the extreme eccentricities, the diversions in topic, the swing grounds, they're all come from Tom Baker. They don't come from Baker, they don't come from Troughton, they don't come from Hartnell. Those sort of aspects of making him very unpredictable, very fast talking, very verbal, all come from him. They don't come from prior to that. So in a lot of ways, the Doctor Who we have now is more of a associationship with Tom Baker than the Doctors before him. So
yeah. Well, no one's really come close to the sort of John Pertwee Doctor, have they?
Well, no one's wanted to.
No one's wanted to. Maybe
no,
that time
wanted
come
to play James
again
Bond
one
as well.
Day. Who knows?
I hope not.
I don't know. I think there's something for it. I'm not talking about walking around dressed as Jimi Hendrix. I'm talking more having a Doctor who's more prepared to use his fists. prepared to get involved in a car chase.
Or more prepared to go and get a stunt double with a white wig on to come and do his...
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think you could honestly say there could be a possible argument that Capaldi might have more in relations with John Pertwee. And this is a guess, obviously, because I've not seen it. I could imagine him having more relationship with John Pertwee than any other doctor.
Right.
In the fact that John Pertwee was quite commanding, was very serious.
Yes.
There was very little humour. There was very occasional warmth, but a lot of the time it was actually quite a cold character. So maybe, again,
Steve Moffat's latest production notes suggested he may be nearer Eccleston or Tom Baker.
Right.
In terms of being a bit dangerous.
Yeah, but he said that with Smith. When Smith came on, he said Smith would be dangerous. And Smith really wasn't until a little later on where he started to get a little bit of that. But for a while he wasn't. But anyway, so you say his 80th. Why are we celebrating his 80th? I never quite understood that. Why whole numbers seem to carry such a massive milestone?
I have no idea. But I think it's Tom Baker, so I don't care in this case.
Because, I mean, 81 is surely more impressive than 80.
Yeah, well, absolutely more impressive than 80. Well, 80 is more impressive than 79. We have slipped into this kind of very kind of macro birthday era, haven't we, with social media where anyone's birthday gets celebrated. And I do personally, and I know lots of fans are happy to go on about people's birthdays, and that's totally up to you. I'm happy that you have the right to do that. For me, it's not my bag at all. I find it quite tedious and boring, but it's 80, so it's quite a big one.
I liked it. Do you remember in October when I tricked you into saying that, and then I could actually point out it was Ian Marta's death day as well?
Yes, I do, yes.
Yeah, that was fun, wasn't it? If you haven't listened to that podcast, it's worth listening to just to hear Christian stumble a little and feel a bit awkward. I remember that as a treasured moment.
Do you really?
I just knew it was going down that route. I was just watching it. I had the grass over the hole and the sticks. Which is luring you towards it with a piece of cheese, or whatever you've got on your plate at the moment.
You're a Sontaran, aren't you? You're a lone Sontaran experimenting on Earth colonists.
I wouldn't quite go that far. I'd have taken that as a bit of an insult if Strax hadn't become so cool. Because before that, Sontarans were a bit of a cumbersome, boring race. But he's really livened them up, hasn't he?
I think it's all down to one actor, really, Dan Starkey. And this, you know, we're going way off script here, aren't we?
We have. Should we go back to script? Sorry, Dan.
Well, no, Dan Starkey's brilliant. And it's good that he's been able to move across to Big Finish as well.
Yes, I know. Isn't that? That's unusual as well. There seems to be a few more ties this of late.
It would be nice if they could get closer.
It would, yes. It would. As I said last week, the beginnings...
I'm talking Big Finish and Doctor Who. No, I'm not talking about Dan Starkey and Big Finish. I'm sure they'd like to get... I don't know the details of their relationship, but for BBC Wales and Big Finish to get closer would be grand.
I think they are. I think slowly that is happening. I don't know why suddenly than before, but I think it's happening. So,
it's probably a relaxation. I think there was certain things. If you take a look at The Writer's Tale, isn't it? There's a few things... in there, and then there's also the DVD extra in the and the Doctor Who magazine with Russell T Davies, that whole feature on bringing back Doctor Who, in which there was like Russell T Davies protected Big Finish from getting closed down, didn't he?
Right, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Getting their license taken away from them, he basically said to Malcolm Young wanted them dealt with, and he said leave it to me, I'll deal with it, and then just left them to carry on.
Good.
It's wonderful.
It's an incredible, because it's one of the few franchises I think in the world really which has such a faithful. I don't like the word extended universe, because it normally sort of means not real universe, or not proper. Do you know what I mean? It's not considered the same. While with Doctor Who, as we've said time and time again, literally having no canon, having no defined hierarchy as well. Everything is, and there is no creator either, so you've got no one to actually establish.
Well, there is a curator.
There is a curator now, indeed. So yeah, it is as canon. I mean, on Facebook, there was when the comic came, Paul McGann in the Name of the Doctor, where he sort of makes reference to Big Finish characters, and someone said, "Hey, Big Finish is canon," and I can't remember which one the Big Finish team. On the Facebook thread said it, but say I didn't know we were never canon. And it's a fair point. It's funny how fans predominantly actually define and actually remove canon more than the actual franchises do. Because nothing in the franchises have said that Big Finish isn't canon. Yeah, if you go to Wikipedia, as I've said many times, you'll see every person who pulls, you know, it's not been established whether this is considered canon or not to Doctor Who. And it's like, well, who's you to say that? Doctor Who doesn't have a canon. So you can't suddenly establish whether it is or isn't as a sort of vagueness any more than you can suddenly chuck out Time and the Rani or, you know, the the Paul McGann movie for the half-human thing. I don't know. Funny people, aren't there, out there? Funny people. I must say, I've been enjoying the comments to these podcasts. I've been trying to get them more involved. Yes, it's been some very nice ones. So thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
I just responded to another one today,
I think on the issue of canon, I may mention this before, Gareth Kavanagh has a video from one of his old warp conventions with there's Paul Cornell and a couple of other people. I can't remember who now. Might be Simon Guerrier, might be one of them. Basically, it's a discussion about canon. And Paul Cornell infuses over this brilliant argument of his that there is no canon. And I think it's a very good argument that he has. And somewhere I'm pretty sure Gareth has got a video of this, which I would love to get hold of. I'll persuade him to put on YouTube so we can share it.
Well, he always said, I remember him in one of Gareth's interviews saying that Russell T. Davies used to say the only canon is what people remember.
Yeah.
And that's all that matters. And while fans bristle at that sort of argument, there is a certain rationale to understanding how you deal with canon within a TV show. Because in the end, it is ultimately there to entertain. It's not there to be a scientific history.
Yeah.
And as soon as you do go down that route, as interestingly enough, you'll see there's a lot of fury in the Star Wars franchises, I'm noticing on Facebook again, over Disney's comments coming from Disney, which, you know, first was saying, well, we're going to protect the extended universe.
Then they've killed the game, haven't they?
And now they're sort of saying, well, actually, sod that. You know, as if they just looked at it and go, oh, my God. No, we can't deal with Chewbacca being dead just because, you know, 800,000 people read the book saying that he's dead. And there is that sort of logic. So I think as far as Big Finish can be, I think it's as canon as anything else. And I think they dovetail quite nicely. And the beauty, we've said this before, the beauty of Doctor Who is its time. And the most important facet of it, unlike, say, Bill and Ted, it's not immutable time. Time changes. And that's part of the story threads. So you can have different versions of things happening and you can have different variations because time can be constantly rewritten, so you don't need a canon, and that's the beauty of it. It's part of the nature. You can't hide from it, and I know fans really do not like that because they love the fact that, you know, you can establish a continuity and you can plot a history, but you can't really with Doctor Who, and that's part of the fun of it. I don't know how far off topic are we now. 800 meters?
No, we're quite close, because we were going to talk about minutes. We were going to talk about Stephen Moffat's revelation in Doctor Who magazine of wanting to include the Peter Cushing movie posters in the Day of the Doctor in Unit, in the Unit base, which is really intriguing and interesting idea.
Because he says, just to clarify to people who don't bother reading Casterbrus or anything to do with Doctor Who, why you're listening to this, God knows why. You might as well stop about now.
I think that if anyone's listening to this who doesn't want to listen to this, they're probably using Stitcher.com and have pressed the wrong button whilst they're driving to Idaho or wherever it is they're going.
That's harsh. If so, Idaho's the other way. But I don't even know where Idaho is. What were we saying? Yeah, because what it was saying was that he wanted to tie in the Peter Cushing movies because he's a very big fan of the Peter Cushing movies, which, of course, you wouldn't be able to tell if you look at the Victory of the Daleks revamp of the Daleks in those very vibrant colours. And the police box as well was sort of slightly Cushing-esque. But he was saying that he would like to have had them as posters in the unit vault room.
That's right.
That they would notice as they go past to establish that the Peter Cushing movies were somehow made within the Doctor Who universe by people who sort of had some understanding of what was going on, but they couldn't afford the licenses to get the posters.
That's pretty much it. In his best Scots accent, Stephen Moffat, who isn't
and your
actually
worst.
Scottish. When I started writing The Day of the Doctor, I knew I wanted every Doctor to make some sort of appearance. And he goes on, but what about Peter Cushing? Now, I love those movies, but they don't exactly fit with the rest of the show. You can. No, he said, do they? You remember that line in the Black Archive when Kate is explaining about the need to screen the Doctor's known associates? She wasn't supposed to be looking at the Vortex Manipulator. Originally, she was walking past the posters for the two Peter Cushing movies. In my head, in the Doctor's universe, those films exist as distorted accounts of his adventures. very clever idea. Well, sadly, they couldn't afford the rights to the posters, which raises an interesting question as to why they couldn't afford the rights to posters of material that was licensed from them in the first place.
Yeah, but the product itself isn't owned by them, is it?
No, it's not.
Someone's bought the license to do that, but that doesn't mean that the people who...
All very complicated, isn't it?
Licensing. Yes, have the rights to the product that's been made, per se. So, yeah, I think it is a... At the same time...
Surely they could have created their own posters then, couldn't they?
Well, I mean, it depends on how much you wanted the line. I mean, you could have even not had the posters and had someone pointing out, pointing in sort of... had a poster off screen and sort of saying, I don't know, you could make it work if you wanted it to, but I'm not sure I want it to.
Because why not?
Well, there's a lot in Doctor Who has this really weird, uncomfortable fusion, which it tries to ignore as much as it can for the sake of the fact it's just a TV show, between the Doctor being unknown on Earth and the Doctor being known on Earth, and the fact that people sort of surprise that there is a 20th century police box on the corner. Now, if you suddenly have Doctor Who as actually an old 60s show that had films which had a police box and a time-travelling person, not saying everyone would know that, because not everyone knows sort of Hammer, all the Hammer films of the era.
All the
carry-ons. But it sort of really, it sort of takes away the ability to keep him in that story construct, keep him easily in the story construct as that unknown antagonist in a problem that is going on, which doesn't always have to be the case. But Doctor Who often likes to enjoy the idea of the Doctor wandering into something. People go, who is that person? Or what is that police box? Or, oh, my God, it's bigger on the inside. You know, as soon as you actually sort of have it established in the universe's media about a police box, which is quite a defined thing, that's bigger on the inside. Are you not taking another bit of a strand away from that complex ability to balance out the fact the Doctor's been around and done everything with everyone, and everyone seems to find him in history, and even Clara's kids, they're not her, literally her kids, or at least we're not told they're her kids yet. Maybe we'll find out later on in some really weird, grotesque sexual distortion of the past history of Clara Oswald. But those two children in Crimson Horror, you know, at the very end, they were just sort of wandering through the internet and they found stuff about the Doctor and her, essentially. So, you know, does it push it down that route? It's a nice homage to Peter Cushing fan film.
What on earth were they searching for anyway?
Well, it was a stupid scene. It made me angry because it was just so utterly... You know, I was talking to someone on one of our comments page, and I was sort of saying, we were both agreeing that, people, what people like in Doctor Who, what they don't like is all a matter of opinion and everything. But I'm sorry, I'm going to have to get quite dictatorial and become quite totalitarian on this issue. But that last epilogue to the Crimson Tide is the worst bit of Doctor Who I think I've ever seen. Mm. I think that even beats Time and the Rani, which never thought I would ever say. Come on, tell me.
I think it's getting close.
It's getting close. I mean, the only thing you've got is you've got a more that Clara, I think, is better acted than majority of anyone in Time and the Rani, sadly. Yeah. Yeah. But beyond that, nothing in that epilogue makes sense. The only thing you can say in its fairness is it only had 4 minutes to be awful, while Time and the Rani had 90 minutes to be good and failed. So, but that is a terrible scene. It's a bit terrible scene.
I don't watch as much children's television as perhaps I may do as my two twins get older. But certainly, it's sub anything on CBeebies that I've watched recently.
Well, it's sub Sarah Jane.
Definitely.
It just didn't make any sense. I mean, that's the point. It wasn't so much the tone. It was that it made zero sense. It diluted her and the characters. I mean, there's no way that she would suddenly go, oh, my God, they found out who I am. They found my secret identity. You know, I'm going to have to, and now they're going to tell their dad, who's going to believe them instantly. Well, maybe the dad will, because maybe the dad's got Peter Cushing films in his bloody library. So maybe that would make sense then.
That isn't the conclusion that one would jump to, is it? You found pictures of your
yes,
au
exactly.
pair on the internet in 1872 and 1983 or whatever. You're either going to think it's her mother or an auntie or older
exactly.
sister, or someone's been playing with Photoshop. You're not going to think, whoa, timey-wimey.
It's terrible. It's absolutely a terrible scene. And given that, you know, Stephen Moffat is not a terrible writer, nor is Gatiss. I mean, even if you just want to go to The Adventures in Time and Space as a perfect example of how much quality he can bring to writing. Who the hell wrote that And I know very, you know, you don't have to know much about Doctor Who to know just by instinct that was a last minute scene, a last minute rewrite, because it just didn't feel right at all. And so what's this? Are we now 50 miles from Idaho? How far off topic are we?
No, we're still close, I think. We can do this. We can do this.
Well, we've got no Brian to anchor us. So
well,
it's...
that's true, yes. Well, you know, the superhero training is important. So while he's climbing around Philadelphia in his Spider-Man outfit, let us first, before we proceed, I just want to tell everyone who's a fan of the Warp magazines, that Gareth Cavanagh and Colin Brock has produced, and who might, you know, for whatever reason, have an obsessive need to see the first issue of Time Leech in its original place. Gareth has found, excuse me, a box or two, a box featuring several issues of both cover versions, both versions with different covers, of What Vault Magazine issue one.
Oh.
Yeah. So he's going to be giving them away this week to people for money, in exchange for money. Not for free. So there should still be some available by the time you get to hear this, if it's kind of the same week that we're recording this. So if you head to Facebook and look up the Vault Vault group and join it, you should be in with a chance of buying one.
Vault Vault's very good. Vault Vault's like, it's like this, but with facts.
And in print.
And in print. And very well designed print as well. It's disgustingly
Vault
well
Vault
designed.
Vault Vault is essentially to Doctor Who magazine what Doctor Who magazine is to Doctor Who, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, absolutely.
And it's superbly produced, and a great inspiration for James and myself as well.
And a feeling of disgust and jealousy from you, not me.
Thanks.
All right. 60 miles off topic.
Getting there. Okay, so our next topic, which we've never said before and probably won't again. We're interested to find that there was a really interesting article published on Costarbus. That wasn't what was interesting to find, because that happens all the time. But the source material was really interesting. It was by Dr. Richard Wallace. And it was called Doctor Who and the Changing Value of Television. It has a much longer title than that, and you can find all the information you need about it in the show notes, because you'll need to give it a good read. And it's basically analysing and looking at this whole... I just spotted a typing error there as well. Whole side of Doctor Who's missing episodes and what the BBC did with them and what they're doing with them now. For instance, of the 253 episodes of Doctor Who produced by the BBC between 63 and 69, 97 are missing. The find, when they discovered those the other few months ago, represented the largest discovery of missing episodes ever and made front page news. Now, in those days, clearly the BBC felt, he goes on, that the programmes that it was making were worth less than the videotape that they were made on. And the whole thing's about this whole disposable attitude that the BBC had then.
Yeah.
To their programming. I think it's quite important to remember that there is more to missing episodes than Doctor Who, isn't there?
Elaborate.
Well, there are other shows and other series that the BBC that were junked and that could prove to be money spinners.
But at the same time, I mean, in the day when they were being junked, and the people involved, I mean, something I found, especially with entertainment and television, through my experience and through experience of people that I know who work in television and journalism, is that people assume that people involved in this are not just professional, but they're robots, that they do everything with foresight, hindsight, and a perfectly cold and rational intellectual approach. I remember talking to a couple of people down the pub a couple of months ago, and we were sort of having an argument, because I was sort of saying that, you know, from what I hear, there are people within the BBC hierarchy who aren't overly keen on some of the aspects of Doctor Who's direction, and specifically the scheduling. And, you know, it causes problems, and that sort of irritation. They're going, no, don't be silly. You know, Stephen Moffat does a fantastic job. It's internationally famous. He's as safe as houses. No one's going to have a go at him. And so people aren't like that. You know, it's not just whether someone is doing good or not. People are people, and they make mistakes, and they make short-sighted decisions. They make wrong decisions. And at a time where there was no real video recording, not especially not certainly not on a domestic use, there was no need, you know, there was no real idea of that sort of market ever becoming a consumer one.
Mm.
It's not surprising in the end for a corporation which is just there to broadcast. It's not there to output as a commercial arm. You've got to remember at the time, it was doing virtually nothing as a commercial arm. It was solely a corporation for broadcasting.
Well, it's not entirely true because we've actually got an interview with Dave with Terry Nation coming on Castover shortly, an archive interview by Dave Rudin, in which he expresses how prior to the Daleks coming along, there was absolutely zero of what you've just said. And it was the Daleks that kickstarted that. But other than that, yeah, you're absolutely right. But
the Daleks, they kickstarted what?
The BBC's sort of commercial ventures.
Right, oh, I see what you mean. You mean within the sort of memorabilia, sorry, the merchandise.
Yes, the merchandise,
point. I was talking more within the sense of the actual items of broadcast being available for commercial consumption.
Yes, yes.
I just think there's a tendency, it's easy to look with hindsight, but at the time when you don't have any of that platform at all, and you are there as a solely as an outputter of broadcasting, not as a commercial product making. I mean, the nearest thing you could compare it to is obviously that you would send to overseas for broadcasting.
Yeah,
you would sell to overseas buyers, but that'd be it. So in a way, you kind of see where that sort of happened with them, why they were deleted in that sort of sense. And I know what people would say in return, that it is a heinous crime, given that, you know, these are historical. But then you've got to imagine, you've got to remember at the time, they weren't considered historical. I mean, you see at the moment, you see internet websites which are just destroyed. I mean, you might have archive.org, which might pick up some remnants. But you get, I mean, you remember the era, like, you know, even like, what, 10 years ago, where mm-hmm. Angel Fire and GeoCities had a whole host of fan sites. Now, I'm not saying that they are as of value of anyone as anything else. But, you know, it's considered disposable at the time and then historically fascinating later on. And you will find people who will search through archive.org desperately trying to piece together old sites because there will be material there that's lost. Commentary, ideas, essays. But at the time, no one sees the commercial value. And that's just who we are. So, yeah, maybe I'm defending BBC for being...
Well, no, I think it is defensible in many ways because we're... fortunate to live in this age of digital technology.
Yeah.
And we have spent the majority of our lives living in a world that has been enhanced by digital technology. Maybe we haven't been working with it for as long a period, but, you know, I'm going back to like the fax machines, how computers revolutionized banking and things like that from the late 60s onwards.
Yeah.
But particularly in the 1980s. Back in the... If you go back 100 years, the way in which... media, and I don't like using the term to include everything, but in this respect, what I will have to, and I'm talking books, magazines, music, the way it's produced and recorded and distributed has changed immeasurably. So getting to where we... Sorry, go on.
So is the audience response, because in a sense, at the time, television was looked, to a certain degree, was looked down upon. You know, writers who wrote for television, not like today, where people actually go solely into becoming television writers. You know, writers weren't necessarily people who would be trained to write in that single format. It wasn't considered that sort of art. Same like comic art. You know, comic art in the 60s, 70s, you know, a lot of comic artists were illustrators who were doing comic art. They weren't nowadays. They're people who just go into art because they love comics. There's a different sort of perspective on the product as well, so it wasn't seen as a serious piece of history that we see it as, you know, even through internally and externally. So it's
that's fine, because that was kind of along the lines of that I was getting at. We're in a very different world, and in hindsight it does look as though the BBC and ITV and, you know, all the various we say ITV, but we don't really mean ITV, we mean sort of ATV and Rediffusion and all these other little portions that made up the old, what we now call ITV, they made these, an ITC, they made the mistake of junking things when really it wasn't a mistake. It was economically necessary, and this was a new format, a new medium in many ways, like the internet is.
Exactly.
And there was just not the opportunity to know what was going to happen in the future. There was no way anyone could possibly know that we would be able to carry around entire series of our favourite programmes on a DVD.
I remember when I was young, my dad would say to me, you know, you'll never get a massive TV screen because, you know, there's only a certain amount of lines you can have on a television, on an analogue television, not realising that, you know, in the future, you wouldn't be using analogue televisions, you'd not be using lines, so screens could be massively larger. You know, there's so many ways that we all sort of, we don't foresee where things are going to go because we can't. And, you know, it's kind of funny now you look at the, like, the Star Trek communicators. I mean, OK, we can say, well, they worked from orbit and they had lots of little functions. But by and large, they are simpler devices than your mobile phone is now. Because, you know, people didn't foresee quite how much technology you could genuinely pack into something so small. Yeah. So, yeah, no, it's a fascinating thing. And I feel for the BBC. And I feel a little bit for them now because there is this general feeling that they are now, which is in part of what the article is sort of talking about as well, being crassly commercial with their products. That you know, suddenly now they've got a whiff that there's money to be made, and suddenly there's suddenly they're now eager because there's you know, that is the nature of business, that is the nature of industry, and you know, in a sense, you know, the shareholders or, you know, the BBC, even the taxpayer might be quite furious if, to a certain degree, the BBC wasn't trying to. Its various arms weren't trying to maximise the potential in these various products. There is no doubt that Doctor Who is a serious commodity. There's no doubt that Doctor Who can make money. And, you know, in the end, you want a capitalistic society where you can go and buy the Web of Fear on DVD. You're going to have to accept that you're going to need people behind that who are going to have the skills of marketing that correctly to make the money required. So, you know, it's all very easy to be tabloid about the BBC and how it's approaching and, you know, eyebrows raised. I must admit my eyebrows raised the way that it immediately went out onto Apple, iTunes, iStore, iShop, iSodding, whatever. You know, straight away, you know, it seemed almost like quite crazy. Your broadcasting corporation, the first thing you do, is you don't even prep it for DVD release. You sling it onto Apple to sell on an Apple platform. But, you know, who does that hurt? It doesn't hurt anyone. But yeah, it's a fascinating thing, the missing episodes. It's going to be interesting to see how they deal with them if and when more appear.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting as well to see what other shows pop up with missing episodes over the next.
Is there any shows that you particularly want to see which you've got missing episodes or miss episodes which aren't in their full?
I'd be interested to see the now handful of missing Dad's Army episodes, I think. And I think there's a few Markham and Wise that are missing as well. But it's really only comedy for me. I can't really think of anything else. I'm not desperate to view missing episodes of Crossroads or.
No. I mean, there's stuff, again, historical, which would be interesting, like Steptoe and Son, I believe, has got some missing stuff.
Yes.
As you say, yes, Morecambe and Wise and the ilk. But, yeah, Doctor Who does unfortunately stand out to me because it is, I don't know, as I say, especially the 60s ones being so live, there's such a fascinating approach to television, especially when you take Doctor Who even more so, because, you know, say take its first, you know, year when it's in Lime Grove and you've got no space at all, and yet you're having to do these horrendously complex story staging. It's fascinating watching them having to get it right. And so, yeah, no, it's fingers crossed we're going to see a lot more of them. It'll be just interesting to see how they're outputted.
Absolutely. Okay, so missing episodes update, there you go. There is no update, but we're fascinated to find out how they're going to be distributed in future and just, you know, how it all came about. Although, of course, if they're no longer missing again, then the BBC is pretty much, does the BBC get off? Is the BBC vilified? Do they get off? Do they, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, because they've held that cross for a long, long time. Junking those, but.
Is there a time traveller involved in all of this, do you think?
It is very rum. It is very queer, isn't it? How it's just all come to head at once. As I said before, it's like someone started rewriting a season and second season, and suddenly they've decided that something that was before is going to totally change. Like, you know, the Time Lords are coming back, and
time can be rewritten, as Miss Pond says. It's the crack, isn't it? That's what it is. It's Amy's crack.
Well, I was actually wondering, and I paused to not think about that. Whether, you know, if Peter Cushing's films are in the Doctor universe, because you could argue just because we didn't see them, because the current writer, head writer, has decided they would be, they are, was Wilf actually playing under the name Bernard Cribbins? And
then that breaks it, doesn't it?
It would a bit, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because he would, his lack of understanding about the Doctor, everything would be a little more confusing. Yeah. But then, at the same time, when he enters the TARDIS, he says, I thought it would be cleaner. Now, the TARDIS in the Peter Cushing film that he would have been in under this, under the non-diplume of Bernard Cribbins was a very clean, quite white, functional thing. So maybe it was stirring some old memories. Maybe he spent a lot of time in the film career, when he, a lot of shows. And it was just...
They made a film about trains as well. Or sat on a big chair and told stories to a camera.
It is always interesting when you, I always wonder that, you know, can you sort of bring those characters, those actual living people, into those universes like that and sort of rewrite their history?
You know, I was watching Old Jack's Boat the other day, which for the uninitiated is a children's TV show on the CBeebies digital channel, which stars Bernard Cribbins as Old Jack, and it's filmed just down the coast from me. Also in it is Martha Jones, actress Freema Agyeman, among other people who may or may not have any relationship to the Doctor universe. And Russell T Davies has written an episode or two of it as well. And, you know, it got me thinking about Bernard Cribbins, because he's far on in his years as well. And he also was offered Doctor Who back when Tom Baker got the job. And as a kid growing up, I would see Bernard Cribbins either on a bank holiday in the Railway Children or on Jackanory. And it always struck me that he was... I very rarely watched a Jackanory that Bernard Cribbins was not reading.
He did seem to do a few, didn't he?
Well, he did do a few, but also I felt as though... and this is a genuine recollection. It's not just something I've realised recently. I've only watched his because I felt he was a better reader than some of the others that they had on, and I just felt more comfortable with him reading. The only other one I can remember watching was Rick Mayall doing George's Marvelous Medicine.
Oh, I remember Peter Davison.
Was it the James and the Giant Peach? It was one of the two.
James and the Giant Peach, I think.
Was it? Right, okay.
I think so. But yeah, but it's funny because, I mean, time does play tricks. I mean, as I said earlier in this podcast, we talk about Bagpuss. And I remember Bagpuss really well. It was a children's TV show about a saggy cloth cat that sat in the window of an old toy shop. And there was only 13 episodes ever made. And so many of those old shows, you look back and you realise how little they were made. But as a kid, they seem to go on for so long, so much longer. The only one that surprised me is that for Christmas, my sister got me the DVD of Jamie and His Magic Torch, which was Cosgrove Hall early production.
With one of the greatest theme tunes ever.
It has one of the greatest theme tunes ever. If you go onto YouTube, you will find it. You know, it is the precursor to the sonic screwdriver. It's a little kid called Jamie who has a magic torch, which opens up a world of cuckoo land, which he goes into in each episode, does something amazing with his magic torch. But there was actually slightly more episodes than I realized. I think there was about 36 made of that, which was, I think it was about two seasons. Wow. Yeah, which is unusual compared to, as I say, to most of them.
So how long were they? Were they about 12 minutes long?
They weren't long. They're about 15 minutes. Right. I mean, we could actually look up on Wikipedia to see how many they did. But
well, you know, a classic lunchtime for me would have been coming home from school for my lunch and sticking on ITV, because they didn't have children's programmes on BBC on lunchtime in the 80s, and watching Jamie and His Magic Torch and Rainbow.
Yeah.
To fill up the 30 minutes. And then it's back to school.
Absolutely. Well, that's it. It's just one of those. I was just trying to see how many they did. 76 to 79, but 10 minutes each they were, three series, but it doesn't say how many there were per series. But that was an unusually quite a long one. But again, it goes back to the missing episodes. Is that at the time, no one would have imagined that people or even adults would buy these in their 30s and 40s, 30 to 40 years later. Because again, it was disposable television, and you know, Doctor Who is in some ways arguably one of the biggest products that was disposable television, just simply in the grounds that they just didn't have time, that everything was rushed just to get that one story out. I mean, and people talk about the budget, but it wasn't just the budget. There was a lot to get through, a lot to do, unions, and you know, tight schedules for shooting. it all had to go out. So it was disposable television in the sense that they were just sort of banging out episodes as fast as they could. You know, there wasn't that time to really sort of think beyond that. So it was, in a lot of ways, disposable television in the sense that it was written on, you know, fast and furiously. So, you know, in a sense, even from that perspective, you can understand why the BBC would not necessarily see its worth. And, I think that's always been the case with Doctor Who. And I still think that can still be the case to a degree. I was saying this to someone on the podcast comments that we had. You know, he suggested, he was saying, you know, how that the lack of ratings in Doctor Who killed it in 89, sorry. And I don't think it was.
No.
It was... I mean, this is like I was talking to a journalist friend of mine about Ripper Street, which I think is quite likely it might return. You know, compared to what Ripper Street had a massive drop in its ratings, but it was up against a very, very one of the most watched TV shows concurrently.
What was it?
I'm a Celebrity Get Me Out.
Oh, right, of course it was, yeah.
One part, and I think there was something else before that. And the same with Doctor Who. I mean, you know, at the time, Coronation Street was hitting, you know, 15, 16, 17 million, as I recall.
Yeah.
Now, you know, of the total viewership of television at the time, and given if people remember that there was only four channels when that was happening, that is a very high percentage. And Doctor Who was still scoring between four and a half million, depending on the episode. It wasn't really doing that badly within its slot. And you could even argue that of all the shows that they could put in there, maybe, you know, the Doctor Who wasn't a bad choice to run up against one of the most popular shows in the country.
Well, what other shows did they put against Coronation Street?
Well, this is what I was thinking. I honestly couldn't really think, but I couldn't really think of many apart from a rival soap, which would be an extremely stupid thing to do, that you would actually put up against it. So in a sense, while I do think that there was a sort of fledging support for Doctor Who in the BBC at the time, there's no doubt about that, I don't think that they were doing it to kill it. I think it was considered a reasonable show which would hold its own reasonably against an unsurmountable enemy. And then at the end, you know, the mandate and the decisions and changes within the actual BBC in relationships to drama was what just, you know, took Doctor Who onto a hiatus. And again, as I said today, if Doctor Who does that again, that will be the reason, I think. It won't be because it's popular. It won't be because it's quality. It will be because there'll be a change in direction within the BBC. And that's why I think when people sort of say, oh, well, you know, it's doomed or it's never going to be doomed, they're wrong, because the reasons for it to stop will not be to do with its ratings. It will be to do with something else. But people just don't appreciate stuff. I think that's the topic of this podcast, really. You know, we don't really appreciate stuff at the time.
Yeah.
80-100 miles away from Idaho now, I reckon.
80-100? Is that how you say 8,000?
80-100, yes. Yeah.
11-teen. Stephen Moffat is, as you are no doubt aware, unless you are the time traveller who's been finding episodes of Doctor Who and bringing them back, he's the man in charge of Doctor Who these days. And he has appeared recently on the radio, on the Chris Evans Breakfast Show, in order to discuss Sherlock. And he was asked about plot holes.
Mm.
Now, there's a full... this week's show notes are going to be very long on the Casterbridge webpage. So if you're listening to this on Audio Boo or Stitcher or on iTunes, you may need to pop back to Casterbridge to click on the links. We will link to this. But the key aspect of his reply was, I think people, in his best Scots accent, I think people have come to think a plot hole is something that isn't explained on screen. A plot hole is actually something that can't be explained. Sometimes you expect the audience to put two and two together for themselves. For Sherlock and indeed Doctor Who, I've always made the assumption that the audience is clever. Now, there is an argument that some of the things that people have been calling plot holes and plot holes, depends on what you consider to be a plot hole and whether this is an accurate assessment of what a plot hole is. Thank you, James. What do you think? I mean, should he even have bothered answering it if this is the case?
It depends on the context of what it is. I agree with him that a lot of stuff is considered plot holes that isn't. There was in Battlestar Galactica a few years ago, it was a great example Ron Moore made. There was an episode where one of the characters, Baltar, is on one ship, and then in the next act, he's back on the other ship. And he said people sort of said, well, we don't know how he got from the one ship back to the other ship, the enemy ship, to that ship. And he said, well, you know, we did consider, do we write to explain that? And then we thought, it's not really important. He got to the other ship. We don't need to know how he got there. He got there. You can't cover everything.
Well, this gets us into the Star Wars conversation you and I had last week, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, it does.
With the special editions and showing Darth Vader leaving Cloud City.
Yes.
Or sort of summoning his transport and then leaving Cloud City.
Yes. I was talking to Christian about this in a very sort of over-the-top way. You know, in Star Wars and Special Editions, I was watching the other week, and you have this wonderful thing at the end. It was about how the toning, the pace and the tone of the end of Empire Strikes Back is suddenly ruined in the Special Editions, because you get this very big pace, you get this very big rushing excitement of Han Solo and being frozen in carbonite, Leia, Lando, heading out. You've got Luke coming to Cloud City. The move, the music's really bringing up pace. And then suddenly, George Lucas and his mates suddenly thought, hang on, at this moment, people will be wondering, because they're about to escape from Cloud City. And in a few 10 minutes' time, we'll see Darth Vader on the Star Destroyer. And at the moment, he's on Cloud City. People are going to be wondering how the hell he got to clouds from Cloud City to the Star Destroyer. So through this pace, everything's really moving. It's moving fast. Suddenly it breaks, and suddenly you have this shot of Vader walking down a corridor, and he says, "Bring me my shuttle so I can get to my Star Destroyer." And then it goes back in, and then it just breaks the pace, and it goes back into this, you know, the original flow of the edit, which is weird. And then again later on, they're on their way, they're escaping, and then suddenly it stops again, and it's as if the writer's thinking, well, wait a sec, they don't know that Vader actually got off Cloud City to the Star Destroyer. We need to validate the fact that he isn't still waiting on Cloud City for his Star Destroyer. Yeah, exactly. He is now on the Star Destroyer. So it breaks again, and you have this shuttle landing on the Star Destroyer. And it's an example of, if you're audience is stuck thinking about something other than what's happening at the moment, you've got a problem. And to break up the pace for that seemed to be a nonsensical plot hole. It was not a plot hole. People might have wondered how Vader got to his Star Destroyer, but that's not a plot hole because it's not relevant.
Well, they might have wondered how he got to the Cloud City as well.
Oh, absolutely. You never saw that. I mean, you get this thing, oh, they arrived before you did. And you know, well, where are all the Star Destroyers? You know, it just doesn't... It's not important. Now, Stephen Moffat, does he do plot holes? I think there are some things that... what do you think? Because, I mean,
there's some things that might be his fault that from his scripts that could be plot holes, and the things that other people's scripts that might be plot holes. What is a plot hole?
Define
a plot hole before we can decide whether the mobster is responsible for it.
Well, this is what I was wondering, what in context was... Because we'll talk about Sherlock, which I think actually a lot of people would be quite interested in talking about. Sherlock this season, I think he made several mistakes, but I don't necessarily think they were plot holes. The only plot hole I felt wasn't covered, but sort of was at the end of season two. Now, if you've not watched Sherlock, you might want to sort of fast forward over this, but I'm going to spoil it anyway because it's now 2 years old. At the end of season two, there is a situation where Sherlock and Watson are on the run from the police. The police are out to get them. They've been framed. They're on the run. And then for the last act, where you have Sherlock on the roof, Watson's just running through London, going to a place where they know that Sherlock and Watson hang out. And there's no police around. There's no one. It's as if the police have forgotten about them. And to me at the time, that seemed to me a big plot hole, because suddenly I was taken out of the moment, because I was thinking, where are the police? You've made a big thing that they're now number one fugitives in London and they're able to wander around. Season three sort of suggests that there might have been Mycroft, Sherlock's brother, involved in the end of season two's mysterious cliffhanger. And that could explain why the police weren't there. It could be that Mycroft sort of was pulling strings. There was a plan underfoot, but it's never directly suggested. So again, it's not a plot hole, I would say, possibly, because you could probably cover it, but there is a question of whether the audience needed to have that capped, because it was quite a big thing, I felt, at the end of the second season. It ruined the episode for me, and it didn't make sense. So plot holes are a very hard thing to...
Well, let's have a look at Wikipedia.
Okay.
The font of all knowledge in the Western world. And another part of the world as well. It's multilingual. A plot hole is a gap or inconsistency in a storyline that goes against the flow of logic established by the story's plot, or it constitutes a blatant omission of relevant information regarding the plot, sometimes even contradicting itself. These include such things as unlikely behavior or actions of characters, illogical or impossible events, events happening for no apparent reason, or statements or events that contradict earlier events in the storyline. There are three very good examples here, which I will give. I'll give you all three because they're all very good. In King Kong, the ape scales the Empire State Building at the end of the movie. However, if he can climb to the top of a skyscraper, he should have been able to climb over the wall that the natives built to keep him at bay on his island.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, the natives built the door in the wall tall enough for Kong to walk straight through. In Marnie, the main character is afraid of anything red, but wears red lipstick. And in Back to the Future, I'm not so sure about this one, but the main character travels back in time where he influences his parents' lives. After he returns to the present, his parents don't recognize him as the boy from 30 years earlier. They might have done, they might just, you know, notice.
I think that's a stretch, isn't it?
I think that's a stretch.
I know what they mean. I mean, it's a very famous.
It doesn't necessarily have to have happened in the film, does it?
No, well, that's exactly. I mean, we don't remember people perfectly. You're not likely to think that he's a time traveler. It goes back to the whole thing we were saying early on about remembering people from. I'm trying to think what we were talking about, but there was something that was very similar to that we were referring to.
Yes.
No, I don't know. I mean, I suppose with Sherlock, I would say they felt. I mean, the second episode there was a lot of hoo-ha over it. A lot of people felt very divided on it. One of the problems with the second episode, I could sort of understand, and I've made this sort of very tabloid comment, that they seem to have mistaken Sherlock for Sheldon from Big Bang, and suddenly Sherlock, who is a character, you know, the original character was not someone who couldn't deal with people. He was not someone who would feel awkward doing a speech. He was someone who was bored by people. He was so intelligent, he was bored by everything except the most elaborate crimes that could intellectually stimulate him. And now suddenly in the Sherlock of Moffat's, he's suddenly sort of becoming taking those Sheldon tropes of being really awkward dealing with people. He doesn't understand people. He doesn't read people very well. Yet at the same time, he's able in the third one to sort of manipulate a girl into thinking that he's going to ask her to marry him.
Yeah.
You know, that could be considered an inconsistency. I would certainly say it's perhaps a bit of a derivative of where this Sherlock was, that he never struck me as being someone who would have a problem doing a speech to people. He just, that possibly, well, I think the biggest,
well, bringing him back to Doctor Who, do you think that in the time of the Doctor, Christmas episode, where he's on a planet where he can't lie and then he lies in the truth field?
Well, yes, that is definitely
that's a hole.
That's definitely a plot hole. Yes, yeah. I would say that's definitely a plot hole. Yeah, no, I agree. I actually thought of that one, but yes, that's quite a big one indeed. But I don't really think Doctor Who. I can't think of that much in his writing I would say is plot holes. I'd say his biggest problem to me is there's a lot of tonal inconsistencies or use of characters which. I don't feel are particularly true, but does that mean that they're full of inconsistencies? I'd say they're too full of tropes. Yeah, I don't know. Of all the things I'd level at him, I don't think plot holes are particularly one of them. I mean, I suppose up until this last time of the Doctor, where he does actually explain his whole arc or retcons his whole silence. Crack in the wall arc. I suppose you could say before that there was quite a few plot holes in his time. Even now, we still don't know what the Lodger's sort of time consulish sort of room was.
No,
that disappeared, that reappeared in the
not for definite. It's never been explicitly explained in the series, has it?
Or yes, within context within those episodes, it's never really had any. So. I mean, I don't know. So yeah, there's probably a lot of holes, but they're not. I don't know. As I say, I think the problem with him is that there is often a sort of an inconsistency in tone that probably gets me. I mean, it's like in his first episode of Sherlock, he was sort of slammed for the revelation of what the cliffhanger 2 years before what actually happened. isn't actually explained properly. And he sort of said, well, that's because, you know, you've got to accept there's some magic that you don't ever get. And you think, well, no, because your show is actually about totally the opposite. It's about proving that there is no magic. Everything can be explained, except this one puzzle you've set up that you can't. Now, to me, that is an inconsistency. So, yes, I would say that's a plot hole. That is an inconsistency within the tone of the show. It just doesn't feel right in that sort of sense. It jars. So, yeah, I think he does. But then so does most writers. I suppose there was one in that last episode. Again, might be giving something away. So speed on if you haven't watched the last episode of Sherlock. But at the very end, we find out that the antagonist, the vault, is not an actual vault. And there's no evidence. And yet, to me, at the very end, he wouldn't tell anyone that, because as soon as he tells anyone that, he's a target to assassination. Because if you've actually got nothing on anyone, but you've got information, so at the end, so why would he tell anyone that? He wouldn't tell Sherlock that, who he knew was about to be arrested.
But was he telling, or was he gloating?
But if he was gloating with Sherlock, you'd think he'd probably gloat with other people. As soon as anyone found that out, that one single aspect of his personality, he was dead at the level that
I can't agree with that, to be honest with you. I think it's established that he's watching Sherlock. He considers Sherlock to be an interesting opponent, or at very least an interesting character. And I think he is gloating to him.
But he can't gloat.
I think it's an interesting twist.
He can't gloat, because as soon as he gloats to Sherlock, if Mycroft gets even an idea that there is no evidence to anything he has, that the only evidence is in his head, he's a dead man, because there is no organization or business or government of that sort of level who will let him stay alive. He now becomes a target because he has nothing on anyone bar what he knows. So to me, while it was a very clever reveal, or so it seemed to be, it that's the danger with clever reveals. You can create clever questions, but as soon as you the answers are very hard to make as clever, and they can open you up to wider problems. So, yeah, I think that was a bit of a problem there. So, yeah, I think Moffat does have plot holes. I think sometimes he tries to sort them out. I think in Doctor Who, as I've said before, I think you can get away with them because the show is flexible. You know, people will say, well, you know, his age is inaccurate. You know, he's meant to be 1,200 years old, but he was 950 when he was Colin Baker, 900 when he's Paul when he's Christopher Eccleston, and yet we know he was John Hurt for possibly as long as he was Matt Smith.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you reconcile that? You can't. It is a plot hole. It doesn't make sense. It's inconsistent. But it's Doctor Who. It's time. Who cares?
Okay, then. Well, let us move on, then. Now, as we mentioned earlier, we've got we're planning to bring you an interview with Simon Fisher-Becker later in the week, which will stand as its own kind of special podcast, and that will bring you your weekly dose of Brian Terranova goodness. You strange people. We're going to move on to the recommendations now. James has a recommendation, and I have a recommendation. Do you want to go first, or shall I?
I will rush mine out because mine is only half. I'm listening to the listening at the moment to The Flames of Cadiz, which is a New Adventures Companion Chronicles with William Russell and Caroline Ford by Mark Platt again, as the beginning was last week. I'm halfway through it so far. I would not tell you not to buy it. Is that a double negative there? It's very well acted so far. The performances are good. It's very consistent. It's again another reminder that the Doctor Who should risk a historical or at least a non-monster based story, and see whether it could do it, because I think it's a style which is greatly and sorely missed from the television show.
Okay, I'll go with that. I like Mark Platt. I spoke to him many years ago, about 5 years ago, for Casterbus. And there's an interview on the website, so I think I will stick a little link to that. It was back when he did his first piece for The Big Finish, I think it was.
Oh, I love his work. I mean, on television, Ghostlight, I know a lot of people didn't like it at the time. I still think stands up as one of the strongest, smartest bits of Doctor Who that was which was completed. And in the novels, Lungbarrow took Doctor Who in a direction, or Gallifrey in a direction, which was there are still echoes of it today, in even in like End of Time, with the mysterious lady on Timothy Dalton's table. Mm-hmm. That has a sort of slight
echo. That sounds wrong.
It does, doesn't it? Possibly. I'm sure he was the perfect gentleman. It was a really, that had echoes. And yeah, I know that Sisterhood of Khan and everything sort of had echoes before Lung Barrow, but Lung Barrow does carry, and that was sort of based on ideas that he was hopefully, or is said, was hoping to sort of implement into the non-done season beyond season, what would it be, 27, is it? 25, 26, 27? 27. Season 27 was the one that didn't happen, series 27. Right. So, yes, so I love Mark Platt. I think he's a great, I've listened to him interviewed. He's a great, he sounds a great guy, and he knows his Doctor Who, and he does some very nice things. So, yes, I would say support him and get those Companion Chronicles. What is it that you have that you love this week?
I have been, I haven't been watching The Robots of Death. I've been admiring The Robots of Death.
It's not really a recommendation. It's more of a statement of fact, this, isn't it?
Well, I recommend that you watch it and admire it.
Yeah, but you don't need to recommend because people should watch it.
Well, that is true. Yeah, they should have done it already, basically. But if they haven't, then you need to. Because this is a piece of television from 1977. I'm not sure that it was recorded in 76 or 77, but it aired in 77. And it has, it's the Doctor and Leela on a sand miner. People are getting killed. It's either a member of the crew or it's the robots. The clue is in the title. But what is particularly good about it, there's a couple of good things I like about it. The fact that there's two consecutive stories written by Chris Boucher. So yeah, we get a new companion who becomes well-written through that. I don't think it's happened before, certainly not until the days of Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat and the showrunner, where the new companion gets their voice so well-defined.
Yes.
So that happens. There's also the production design.
Yes.
Fantastic. The interior of the sand miner and the design of the robots, which was so good that Gareth Cavanagh used the same design when he did the pub production of it a few months back. There's the gantry gallery shots.
Yes.
I must have read how they did this at some point, but I imagine they've probably taken a camera into the production gallery, or there's a camera mounted there. So there's aerial shots looking down in the sand mining bridge and in the TARDIS at the beginning. And it's the mahogany TARDIS as well.
Cheers, the secondary control room.
Yes.
Is it the primary?
I can never could remember. And then there's the other thing about it, which I think it's more than just the model work. It's more than just the CSO, the chroma key, the blue screen gubbins, or green screen as they use these days. It's the combination of the two. So you have these excellent establishing shots of the sand miner bridge where the model's got a tiny little sliver of blue or green paint on it. So they can chroma key the footage in there. There's the long shots of the Doctor looking for the TARDIS, walking around the sand miner from the exterior view, and the same thing. It's such a superbly produced piece of Doctor Who. BBC4 should be actively browsing through classic Doctor Who and finding the ones that they could put on that will stand up to really good scrutiny, and that would be one of them.
I think so, because it's pacing as well. It's pacing is perfect. Yeah. It's a play on the old Ten Little Indians, approach, and it works really well. And they've got a good cast as well. The cast is
Russell
really Funder, good.
David Bailey and Pamela Salem, who pops up. I don't know if you know this. Pamela Salem is on the River Cruise. Is it River Cruise? She's on the little small adverts that they have at the end of advert break.
Right, yeah.
On ITV. When they show Midsummer Murders, there's pictures of people lounging around on a cruise ship having enjoyments, mature people, and she's one of those.
Well, it's a great story. There's some lovely little lines. Please do not throw hands at me is probably the most infamous one. There's that lovely line that Tom Baker has about being the inverse ratio between the size of the mouth and the size of the brain, which, again, is just lovely.
It's also got a very good multicultural cast as well.
It has, yes.
Which I never noticed until, not this viewing, but the last one, when I first received it. Received it as part of the revisitation 3 box set. is my copy of Robots of Death, and I'd never noticed it until then. I'm not sort of the person who kind of looks out and counts how many black, Indian, Chinese,
no, exactly,
female characters are. I just get on with the characters as they are. So,
well, especially these days where stuff is far more multi-diversity,
exactly, yeah,
anyway,
yeah,
so you're less likely to notice it.
Yeah. On the subject of which, the character, I'm not sure the name of the actress who plays Silda, I'd always been really annoyed by her because her breakdown in, and if you haven't seen Robots of Death, then you should have done. So I'm really sorry to be spoiling a 37-year-old piece of television for you. When she breaks down in the commander's suite upon discovering what happened to her relation, her acting is absolutely dreadful. But for the rest of it, she's absolutely fine. And I'd always defined her as being an absolutely dreadful, or it being a dreadful performance because of that final thing. But up until that point, she's absolutely fine.
The only criticism I have with Robots of Death, and yes, that scene is slightly melodramatic, and maybe that's as much the director's mistake as hers, is that the revelation to who the killer is far too obvious early on.
Yeah.
The use of voice, the use of distorted imagery, and the use of outfit, which is kept consistent because they only have one outfit each.
Yes.
So you could actually work out who the killer is quite early on, which is a shame.
It is.
It doesn't really take away from it because it's still very well done. Tom Baker's is really at the equilibrium, perfect equilibrium between the humour and seriousness.
Yes.
That he can do, where I think after this season he starts to veer off down the comedy approach. This here, he's really got it where it should be.
Well, there's another line in that same section that you mentioned with the inverse ratio, that bit when... When the commander says something along, I suppose that something, and he says, well, and the doctor just looks down and grins. Well, and says, oh, I thought it was a rhetorical question.
Yes, indeed. Because he says, you know, is it just a coincidence? Is it
that yes, that's a coincidence. Yeah.
In the same place as what, and he's just yes, it's a silence. Oh, sorry, you know, it's a rhetorical. But there's also in that bit, there's a great scene actually that where Brian Croucher, who's obviously in it, yes, as well, who plays that's himself, yeah, plays over the top, great. He makes a comment, and Baker just does that. No,
that's an inference.
Yeah. Yes, and it's just amazing how good shows, and good films. If you watch, they play eventually like a melody in your brain, where sometimes either not just the soundtrack, but the actual dialogue, and will actually play like a melody, and you can hear it in your head almost like a tune, like a verse. And it's not. And good ones like that, and Robots of Death has got loads of that, where you can just feel the harmony of the script.
Yeah,
it is, really is probably one of the best Doctors. It was one of the first ones I got on video. And I remember before that, my first encounter with it was the Target novelization. And it felt fairly close. I mean, there's certain things that I didn't get in the Target novelization, like I didn't realise quite how wacky their clothing was. I didn't realise quite how... I think it is quite multi-ethnic in the book as well. I can't remember, but by and large it plays the same, just with these aesthetic things that you
don't also create. There's also the creation of a very strong sort of believable society as well, isn't there? You really believe, yes, that they've landed in this futuristic civilization,
which you see nothing of bar this sandmine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's very well drawn, the whole thing.
It is possible.
So, if you haven't seen The Robots of Death, that is my recommendation for this week's Casterbridge podcast with a K.
And you say it's on, is it only now available on the restoration?
It's been available for a while, but it was re-released as part of the Visitation.
I'm just wondering whether it is actually still available on its own. I have a feeling you might have to get the...
I'm sure you'd be able to find it. I'm just going to
bring
up the
Amazon. Well, you say that.
Well, you're right. Although, Remembrance of the Daleks...
Not
Remembrance of the Daleks. Not the Time Monster. There's three, isn't there? There's the Time Monster, Horns of Nimon, and...
Underworld
on the box. You can still get Underworld on its own.
There is one that you... And I'm trying to remember which one it is. There is one you can't get on its own anymore, because I was thinking of getting it, and I'm damned if I can remember what it is now.
Well, you still can get Robots of Death on its own, always part of Visitations 3 with extra extras. Read all about it.
Is it worth it with the extra extras, do you think?
I'll maybe come to that next time.
Right,
because I'm
fair enough.
Set down and watch them yet. But either way, it's there, it's out there, it's ready for you to buy. If you want some classic Doctor Who, if you want some classic Tom Baker in the week of Tom Baker's 80th birthday, that's as good a choice as any. which brings us to the end of this week's Casterbridge podcast with a K. Dear listener, we're hoping to bring some Simon Fisher Becker to you later in the week in a separate podcast. But until then, it's goodbye from myself and James. Goodbye.